Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court, I am Jeff Weiner, and I represent the Ray appellants in this case. The first issue I would like to address with the Court is that we respectfully submit that the Superior Court erred in granting the State and Defendant Murphy summary judgment upon the Ray's willful and wanton misconduct claim, driving misconduct claim. The facts which we submit support a claim for conscious indifference on the part of Mr. Murphy are virtually undisputed in the record. April 23, 2004, the day of the accident, was a clear, sunny morning. Route 299, also known as Middletown-Odessa Road, westbound, is a flat, straight roadway. Murphy was familiar with Route 279 westbound and the intersection with Brick Mill Road approximately three-quarters of a mile down the road after he left Route 1, having driven that roadway on several occasions before in connection with his employment. The approximately three-quarters of a mile that Murphy traveled from Route 1 down Route 299 to the intersection with Brick Mill Road had Mr. Murphy's attention focused upon the female escort, Miss Lewis, not the roadway. Mr. Murphy admitted that his eyes were off the roadway for, quote, a few, end quote, seconds, immediately prior to the collision. Mr. Paris, the driver directly behind Mr. Murphy, saw the light change from green to yellow to red and had absolutely no difficulty stopping his vehicle. There is not any evidence in the record of any braking by Mr. Murphy before the collision. Mr. Murphy, by his own admission, consistent with the police report, entered the intersection at 50 to 55 miles per hour. At his deposition, Murphy admitted that he never saw the light after giving three other prior inconsistent, although unsworn, statements. In his first statement, he indicated that the light was yellow. In his second, although unsworn, statement, he indicated that the light was red. And his third statement, he indicated that he thought the light was green.
What was the speed limit when he was going 50 to 55?
My recollection, Your Honor, is 45 miles per hour, but I'm not certain of that. But there was a clear intersection which had a traffic control signal which had changed to red, and the driver immediately behind him stopped. My client proceeded into the intersection, as did the car directly behind her on the green light. And it wasn't really a question of speed because he never slowed his vehicle. The speed earlier was 50 or 55 miles per hour on that road, but he never slowed his vehicle at all. The entire time he was discussing with Miss Lewis a car that they had seen on Route 1, literally sometime, at least 20 seconds earlier.
Well, the problem I'm having is that to make his conduct beyond being negligent and a source of liability into being wanton or conscious indifference or some higher level, doesn't there have to be more than just he wasn't paying attention and he ran through a light?
Oh, I think it is more than that, Your Honor. First, he was aware there was this intersection. He had driven that roadway before. Second, he was driving at 50 to 55 miles per hour by his own speed. He did nothing, knowing that there was an intersection, he just continued to drive while he was speaking to the escort, looking away from the roadway with his eyes off the roadway, not just for a second, but for a significant amount of time. There's no evidence of braking here. There's no evidence of awareness. He drove into an intersection he knew existed at a high rate of speed, 50 to 55 miles per hour.
Driving into an intersection that under other circumstances he would have known was there, how is that willful and wanton? Everybody knows that you stay in a particular lane. Everybody knows what the speed limits are, or is obligated to know what the speed limit is supposed to be. But when people don't exactly meet that standard, just because they don't meet that standard doesn't make them consciously indifferent to the lives of others.
Well, I think it would be a different situation if this was an unfamiliar road, if this was an unfamiliar intersection. This is a gentleman who was familiar with the roadway and familiar with the intersection and familiar with the traffic control light.
And if I'm coming out of the road, my house, to the Dover-Kenton Road, I know there's a stoplight there, but my dog's acting up in the back of the truck, and I turn around to settle the dog, take my eye off where I know there's an intersection just for a moment, because I have to make this conscious effort to settle the dog. That's going to constitute willful and wanton conduct on my part if I go through the intersection and strike another car?
I hate to make it personal, Your Honor.
Oh, please do. I invited it.
If you were under those circumstances, this is not just a second off the roadway where you look up and the light's changed and you saw what was a green light now is a yellow or a red light. This is a situation in which Murphy under oath said he never looked at the light. He never looked at the light. It's more than, there's no evidence of any braking. So he went for a significant period of time on a straight roadway, knowing that there was this light coming up, without taking any action. He didn't, and unlike what I'm sure Your Honor would do, he didn't pull off to the side of the roadway. There's a shoulder. He could have pulled the vehicle off to the side of the roadway. He didn't slow up the vehicle. He kept his head turned to the right, directed to Ms. Lewis while she talked on the cell phone.
Well, going back to Justice Berger's question, which really goes to the heart of it, how do we in a principled way draw a line in fact situations between what constitutes willful and wanton and what constitutes what treatises called simple negligence?
Well, I think what this court has said previously and what Delaware courts have said is normally that issue is left to the jury on the first situation. And I think the line's been drawn, and it was drawn somewhat in the cases that the court cited, we think, erroneously in its opinion by Judge Carpenter. And if I may turn to those two cases, particularly the Pauley case. Judge Carpenter compared this case to the Pauley situation. That's Pauley versus Reinhold, found at 2002 Westlaw 1978931, in which this court, in which, if my recollection serves me, Justice Vaughn granted summary judgment on the willful and wanton misconduct argument. On appeal, although dicta to the end result, this court indicated as guidance to the lower courts that summary judgment was precipitously granted in that case. In Pauley, there were two lay witnesses that estimated Pauley's speed at 30 miles per hour as she went through the intersection. Here, Murphy, by his own admission, was going at a speed of 50 to 55 miles per hour.
It wasn't Pauley, a police officer, responding to a report of a burglary?
That is correct. That is correct, Your Honor. And Judge Carpenter then said that Pauley's conduct was knowingly, in that she went through an intersection against the light with an obstructed view. She should have known that her view was obstructed because there was a Suburban or some other vehicle that was parked that stopped for the red light, which blocked the view of cars that would have been behind the Suburban. Here, we have an even more egregious situation, I submit, because Murphy can't say that he had an obstructed view. He had no view because he never looked.
So going back to how we're going to draw the line in this case for future cases, let's take the light out of the equation for the moment. As I understand your argument, if you're driving down the highway at 55 miles an hour in a 45 mile an hour zone, and you're looking at your passenger for several seconds and you have your eyes off the road, if you rear end someone in front of you or someone steps out, whatever, it would probably be willful or wanton. And we just enhance that in your case by adding the traffic light to the facts.
I think it would normally be an issue left to the jury in each case based upon the specific facts in the case. I think this court has previously said that this type of question is normally a question for the trier of fact. And if you have facts which can give rise to a willful and wanton, such as high speed, 50 to 55 miles, no look at all, that should be an issue of fact for the jury.
Can you help me with the procedural context of this case? As a result of the jury's answers to the jury verdict sheet and the special interrogatories, the award was, the answer was there was no conscious pain and suffering after the injury but prior to death. The answer was no. So as a result of that, what was the judgment in the case? Was judgment entered on the survivorship claim?
There was no judgment entered on the survivorship claim. The judgment was on the, because there was no punitive damage claim at that point in time, there was nothing left to be awarded.
Well, my technical question is, as a result of that answer, was judgment entered in favor of the defendant on the survivorship claim?
Yes, because there was no compensatory damages to be awarded because the death was instantaneous under McGee.
Okay, so you agree then that damages is an element of an actual claim for plaintiff to be awarded a judgment?
Under the second argument that we briefed in the supplemental briefs, that's the second issue that we'll get to this morning, I hope, and that is that even if you cannot or do not have compensatory damages, you should still have a punitive damage claim for the loss of life.
even though judgment's been entered against the plaintiff on the main claim?
Yes, because it was on the instantaneous death where there is no damages.
Well, however we get there, it's a judgment for the defendant is what was entered.
That is correct on that claim, based upon existing case precedent, which does not recognize a survival claim for punitive damages. And that's the second issue that the court raised in the and requested supplemental briefing on.
Are you ready to turn to that issue?
I'd like to finish up with a comparison of the other case that I think I'm, well, I'll do it briefly. The other case that relied upon by Judge Carpenter was Skianter versus City of Wilmington. In Skianter, the police officer was going through an intersection at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Here, Murphy was going through at 50 to 55. In Skianter, the officer looked both ways and didn't see the oncoming traffic. Murphy here never looked at all. And in Skianter, the police officer had a statutory privilege. He had his lights or his warning signals on. Here, Murphy had no privilege, no privilege at all. Now I'd like to turn to the second argument. That's the punitive.
I have one question. Was the defendant in this case prosecuted under 4176A?
He was prosecuted under criminal negligence homicide, if my recollection serves me, and pled guilty to the new statutory provision about vehicle homicide. I have
that's
the exact 4176
citation. 4176A, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure if it's 4176A, but it's the new homicide section that they put in. Newer
that's section. Where you, if your negligence causes a death, you're guilty of a form of homicide.
That's correct, but it didn't rise to the level to support willful wanton misconduct.
So he wasn't charged with manslaughter or anything where the mens rea assumed reckless conduct.
He was not.
Or willful and wanton conduct.
He was not. We alleged it as a civil action.
I understand that.
The second question is whether punitive damages should be recoverable under Section 3701 and 3704, even if death was instantaneous. And the statutory provisions themselves say that any cause of action, except for some limitations such as defamation and malicious prosecution, which the decedent had, survive his or her death. There is no question in this jurisdiction that if a death is not instantaneous, the victim's estate may recover punitive damages. That's been the law since 1892 in the Quinn versus Johnson Forge case, as reaffirmed by this court in Reynolds versus Willis. The secondary issue before this court is whether a victim's estate may recover punitive damages just because the tortfeasor's conduct created an instantaneous death and therefore no compensatory damages. In short, the issue really is whether the Superior Court's comment in McGee versus Rose in 1978 is correct, and we submit it is not. First, majority of courts to have considered the issue have held that a claim for punitive damages survives an actual or nearly instantaneous death.
Does this whole punitive damages argument depend on whether there was willful or wanton conduct?
Yes.
So if we conclude that the judge properly granted summary judgment on the issue of willful and wanton conduct, we don't reach this.
That's
but
correct.
But if we decide that that issue should have been submitted to the jury, and then we reach this punitive damages issue because there's going to be a new trial, and we either say punitive damages is a possibility or it's not.
Agreed. Second, as the Supreme Court in New Jersey said in the Smith versus Whitaker case in 1999, there is no logical reason why a tortfeasor's most egregious misconduct causing an instantaneous death should excuse a tortfeasor from a punitive damage claim. If the victim survives for 15 or 20 minutes of conscious pain and suffering, the tortfeasor has a punitive damage claim for willful and wanton misconduct.
Well, on that logic, why does it make any difference whether the decedent survives even a split second or not?
It should not, because punitive damages are to punish the tortfeasor and deter others from that conduct.
So you would agree that survival doesn't mean anything in terms of awarding punitive damages if there's proof beyond by preponderance of the evidence of willful and wanton conduct?
Agreed, and that's the argument we're advancing, that to the extent there's a comment or a decision either in Pfeiffer or in McGee to the contrary, when you have the ultimate loss, the loss of life, if it's instantaneous, the punitive damage claim for willful and wanton misconduct survives under our statute.
Are you asking, do we have to overrule Stevenson versus Capanum, do we not, to accept your argument?
I don't think it's an overruling of Stevenson as much as it is a McGee and
Well, Stevenson is our case, where this court said award of punitive damages cannot be made unless the plaintiff also receives compensatory damages.
And the reason I backed away from Stevenson was it wasn't a personal injury action, but we do have it in two wrongful death actions. That's McGee and the other case I cited. But yes, to the extent, yes, in that case. But it's not a wrongful death case. Stevenson was a fraud case or a consumer fraud case, if my recollection serves me.
Okay.
Third, relieving a tortfeasor.
So just to follow up on that, are you suggesting we distinguish and say that you, although you have to have compensatory damages in a fraud case, you don't have to have compensatory award in a wrongful death case?
I haven't thought that through that far, Your Honor, as to the principles involved. But at least with the loss of life, the ultimate loss, you should have a punitive damage claim for willful and wanton misconduct. I haven't researched it beyond that issue with Stevenson, although I did comment on Stevenson in the brief. Third, because in a fraud case, if you don't have the compensatory damages, it's a little bit different than somebody's dead, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You have the loss of life.
Death is different.
The third reason why there should be an ability to recover punitive damages in a case involving a loss of life, even if there's no compensatory damages because of an instantaneous death, is because a tortfeasor shouldn't be relieved of the punitive damage exposure and the wrong message sent. First, the message is that economic or compensatory consequences is not critical for the ultimate loss, the loss of life. Even though someone had an instantaneous death and had no what would be equivalent of compensatory damages, should not eliminate the punitive damage claim.
Why shouldn't society be satisfied with criminal punishment?
The society is satisfied with that, but there's no deterrence. There is that you are in essence allowing someone by the expediency of their crime or their criminal or their civil misconduct to benefit therefrom. Speed up, cause a greater collision, cause a greater impact, increase the chance of death, because if the person dies instantaneous, you have no exposure to punitive damages.
Well, the legislature said even mere negligence that fortuitously causes death is punishable as a felony and a serious crime that can subject someone to imprisonment.
But
that doesn't serve as a deterrent?
It's on a totally different standard. It's on the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt as opposed to the civil standard of...
I know it is, but we're talking about the level to which we establish a policy of deterrence. And my only question is, as a state that's statuted to death already, bad pun intended, what more do we need other than criminal penalties to send the message that you shouldn't operate a vehicle in this fashion?
Well, that same argument, if I respectfully submit, Your Honor, would eliminate punitive damages if the person didn't have an instantaneous death, because you still have the same criminal penalties applicable. Right. So why should there be a difference because a tortfeasor caused instantaneous death than someone survived for whatever period of time?
Isn't that for the legislature to remedy? They could amend the wrongful death statute, could they not?
I don't think they had to. I think it's in the statute now. I think it's in 3701 where it says all claims the decedent had. What is not in this, what has not been addressed is the Superior Court's holding in McGee and the other case that followed it, Pfeiffer in 1778.
You're well into your rebuttal time. Did you want to save any?
No, I do not wish to waive the other arguments that are presented in our original set of briefs, but I do want to save some time for rebuttal.
Saving your time doesn't waive any of the arguments in the brief.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Nijelski. As Mr. Wiener has told you, their first argument they made in this appeal was the issue of punitive damages. They believe they couch the issue in terms of willful and wanton. And the truth is that this court has spoken on the issue in Jardel and says perhaps we should use the common terms recklessness. And that's essentially what they would have to show to make a case out. They would have to show recklessness.
Well, how much worse does it have to get before it's reckless?
Well, Your Honor, recklessness, apparently the reason that the Supreme Court chose to use the word in Jardel was because it has many modern equivalents in both the criminal law and other, that the term recklessness is better defined than the term of wanton or willfulness.
Right, but I'm saying in terms of the facts we have here, how much worse could an accident be if this isn't reckless? what do you have to do?
I don't read the record apparently the same way that Mr. Weiner does. The truth of the matter is that there were skid marks left by Mr. Wade Murphy, that he was momentarily inattentive, and that's fairly clear. He's not a very educated person, so he is the kind of person that might have difficulties if you ask him questions, depending on how you ask him the question. But the truth of the matter is, as at trial, he clearly conceded that he was wrong, whatever, that he should have seen the light, he should have been paying attention, and that he wasn't paying attention for another reason. They were trying to report another driver they saw on Route 1, who apparently was falling asleep with children in the back seat. In fact, his attendant, Miss Lewis, was actually on the cell phone with 911 when the accident happened, and that's why we were able to play the tape at trial, and you could actually hear some of this going on at trial. So I would characterize his act strictly the way it is, and that is he should have been paying attention and watching the road. He took his eyes off the road to answer her question and missed the light changing to red, and unfortunately Miss Ray, came from her intersection, came through there, her now green light, and they struck. And that is what happened. It wasn't something where he was clearly trying to do anything wrong or trying to hurt anyone or was engaging in somehow. There's no suggestion at all that on the roadway he was engaging in reckless conduct or willful driving. They were on their way to pick up a patient, a day patient, in Middletown. The van goes and picks up patients at Middletown, in this particular case, brings them back to the hospital for the chronically ill in Smyrna, where they're watched for the day, and then they're returned again at the end of the day.
Well, I understand and appreciate the fact that the way you characterize what happened makes it sound a little bit less offensive, if you will, in terms of what the driver was doing and why his eyes were off the road and so on. But he was going over the speed limit at a controlled intersection that he was distracted long enough that he didn't see that it went from green to yellow to red, not just that it went from yellow to red or whatever. And moreover, he didn't even remember seeing that he was in approaching or in an intersection. Isn't that at least enough to go to a jury to let them decide?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that is. I don't think that's recklessness. I simply don't. I mean, that is doing what he was charged with, was causing the death in a motor vehicle law accident by his negligence.
Well,
perhaps rather than tell us why you simply don't think it's negligence, you can do like Mr. Weiner and show us from other cases where courts have found that these facts in set A constitute recklessness, these facts in set B do not, and where we draw and how we draw the line.
Well, because in this case, Your Honor, we have a singular act of disregarding a red light. I mean, he should have been facing the right. He should have been watching it as it changed. He should have slowed and came to a stop.
Well, there's also a statute that says as one approaches an intersection, you're supposed to slow down and pay particular attention, isn't there?
Yes, Your Honor. You're supposed to, as you're approaching a traffic control device, you're also supposed
to. And is Mr. Weiner correct that the speed limit's 45 and not 50?
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor.
That's incorrect?
I don't believe that is correct, Your Honor.
Well, there's a difference in you not believing it's correct and telling us, is it correct or is it not?
Well, Your Honor, it was never an issue, to my memory, in this case, as to what the speed limit was. There was no allegation that this Mr. Murphy was exceeding the speed limit.
I mean, is a part of the argument to the trial judge about what constituted reckless conduct that would subject one to punitive damage and what was just simple negligence? No one knew what the speed limit was or the relevance of how fast?
Your Honor, it didn't appear to be an issue as to what his speed was. The focus seemed to be on his taking his eyes off the road and the light going from
what is
green
the record,
to yellow
what is the
to
record
red.
Show was the speed limit? What does the record show was the speed limit?
Your Honor, may I?
Well, counsel, perhaps Mr. Monica can look for that information while you're making your presentation. And I'd like to follow up on Justice Berger's question. What more, that is, what additional offensive conduct would have been required in your view for Mr. Murphy's conduct to be properly characterized as reckless?
Well, I think it has to be, Your Honor, a number of, if you will, a number of motor vehicle violations that culminate in an accident. So, for instance, not just, for instance, greatly exceeding the speed limit, doing other things other than even talking to somebody in the car, but just things that are completely unrelated to driving.
For instance?
Talking on a cell phone at the same time you're listening to loud music. You're exceeding the speed limit by 20 miles an hour.
How about looking at your passenger while she's talking on a cell phone and not watching what you're doing?
I would think that's negligence, Your Honor, but it's probably something good or bad that everybody who's driven on the road with pets or kids has done at one time or another, and we turn around and we look at that child or that pet to try to correct.
Well, your position is, well, whatever he did wrong, it's not enough. And then when we ask the follow-up question, well, what would be enough, we're not getting an answer.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I thought I did answer, Your Honor.
Well, you just said they'd have to do a lot more.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that merely not paying attention to the roadway and the changing of the light would be enough. I mean, he was distracted, and that's the reason he wasn't paying for the light.
Yeah, we've heard that, and the question is,
does the state law support that?
I don't know, Your Honor. I know that in Jardel versus Hughes, the Supreme Court talked about there's a legal determination or difference between negligence, even gross negligence, and something much greater than that which is recklessness.
How long did he say that he had his eyes off the road? What does the record reflect?
Seconds.
Pick a number.
Seconds.
All right, so we'll say 4 seconds, 5 seconds. Is that?
Your Honor, probably as much time as it would take to turn to your right, to look, understand what somebody's asking you, answer the question, and turn back around.
So it's your position that if you're looking at the passenger going 55 miles an hour, eyes off the road, and it's more than a glance, if you're fixed on them for a few seconds, that's not a jury question on whether that's reckless to concentrate on the passenger for a significant amount of time, even if it's a few seconds. That as a matter of law, that would not be reckless.
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I simply don't think it is.
And are there any cases one way or the other?
Well, in the case of Jardel versus Hughes, it was a case involving an employee who was abducted, raped, and brutalized from the Dover Mall. And they talked about the level of things necessary to hold the landlord responsible for recklessness.
I know, but if we look at all the cars in the United States, this is your case, you're in the Delaware Supreme Court. My question is, have you found an automobile accident case involving recklessness as a standard of conduct that says either yes, not paying attention for a few seconds is ordinary negligence, or no, it's a jury question for recklessness?
I don't know that I found such a case, Your Honor. I mean, there are cases in which recklessness is discussed, and what that modicum of evidence is necessary to prove recklessness is discussed. And when I look at this particular case,
how do we draw the line? What we have here is a judge who said, as a matter of law, this is not a jury question. How do we articulate that standard?
Well, I think the court did articulate the standard in Jardel versus Hughes, Your Honor, as to what the distinction between recklessness is and negligence, including gross negligence. There was a little bit of a misstatement. In Pauley, the issue was gross negligence versus negligence, not recklessness at all. And gross negligence in this particular case, whether Mr. Murphy's conduct was negligent or grossly negligent, doesn't change anything, the outcome of this case, because gross negligence doesn't change the possibility of damages or anything. It doesn't give you punitive damages, whereas recklessness would. The problem, though, is nevertheless, you still have to make a showing that there's a survival action, because her action for personal injuries doesn't survive unless she, in fact, is she goes through she has some period of period of pain, conscious pain and suffering. Because other than that, it's, like he said, it's instantaneous death. The only way you could get punitive damages from a purely wrongful death action is if the General Assembly were to amend the wrongful death action.
Now, Mr. Weiner told us that his position is, in fact, not inconsistent with that statute's modification of the common law. Why is that wrong?
Because under the common law, you couldn't bring an action for the death of anyone.
Yes, but that's now we have a statute that says the circumstances under which you can bring an action and the damages that you can seek.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Weiner says there's nothing about that statute that's inconsistent with awarding punitive damages in the event of an instantaneous death.
I did.
Why is that wrong?
That is just incorrect. It limits what damages you are, and none of them is punitive damages. In fact, Mr. Weiner,
I don't understand. It limits what damages you are.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It does not provide for the imposition of punitive damages, a wrongful death statute. It
so
does
your
not.
Position, it has to explicitly enumerate what damages can be recoverable in the statute itself, and by exclusion, you can't get punitive damages in the event of an instantaneous
death. Yes, Your Honor, because the General Assembly took the time to say what things are recoverable under the wrongful death statute, by implication, things that are not mentioned would not be recoverable under the wrongful death statute. And more importantly,
Wait a second. If I understand you, you're saying that even if the decedent had survived for 10 or 15 minutes with conscious pain or suffering, there would still be no basis for punitive damages because the statute wouldn't allow it?
No, Your Honor. That would be under the survival statute, 3701.
Okay.
That would be permitted,
okay,
but not under the wrongful death statute.
But here, your position is there's no punitive damages because there's no willful or wanton conduct.
No, there's no punitive damages because there's no survival action. I mean, punitive damages is derivative of some other action. And before you can have a survival action, the decedent has to have conscious pain and suffering. Otherwise, they have not set out a claim for personal injuries under 3701, which could survive.
So, and what's your position with regard to the wrongful death action?
A wrongful death action, Your Honor, is under 3724, and it goes not to the decedent. It does not benefit the decedent. It benefits the next of kin, and it provides for certain lists of remedies and compensation that they are entitled to.
And punitive damages is not one of them.
And punitive damages is not one of them. And, in fact,
Is it your position that the ruling on the denying the punitive damages claim was mooted by the verdict?
Yes, Your Honor.
And was the verdict a judgment for the defendant
on
a survivorship claim?
I think it was, Your Honor, yes. It would be a judgment in favor of the defendant.
Well, Justice Ridgely's original question was such a judgment actually entered? Is that what the record shows? Judgment for the defendant on that claim?
Judgment, Your Honor, with the practice, unlike in federal court where there's a specific practice for entering a judgment, a specific written judgment, my understanding is the verdict itself becomes the judgment of the court. There's no document that expressly enters it as a judgment, one way or the other.
So are you saying in this situation a verdict that reflects no damages for the survival action is all the record shows? There was no follow-up judgment then entered for the defendant on that claim?
Your Honor, there was a verdict sheet that was delivered by the jury that was entered as a document in this case. And it asked two questions about the survival action. The first question, was there a appreciable period of pain, conscious pain and suffering? They answered no. They were directed at that, based on that, right, just skipped to question three, and they went to the issue of wrongful death damages.
So even in the absence of any written order entered by the trial judge at the conclusion of the trial, there's not even a docket entry that says judgment entered for the defendant on the survivor claim?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor, a separate document. I believe that that is from the verdict sheet, however, okay, which is part of the...
Any other questions?
Your Honor, we have found the question. It's in the appellant's Appendix A at page 74 is the police report. The speed limit listed for the vehicle is 50 miles an hour.
Thank you.
And do we know what the speed limit was?
Yes, limit for number one, which is Wade Murphy, is 50 miles an hour, Your Honor.
Is that how fast he was going, or is that?
No, that's what the posted speed limit for he would.
So he was doing 55 in a 50.
Well, no, Your Honor, I believe his testimony was he was doing the speed limit 50 to 55.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not sure what Mr. Nierjowski is pointing to as to the speed limit. I think it's the Uniform Traffic Collision Report, but I'd like to call Your Honor's attention to, I'll concede that it's the Brick Mill Road that has the 45 miles. It's set forth in writing on Appendix 101, page 101. That's the speed limit on the roadway. Secondly,
well, I'm very confused. Where this accident occurred, the posted speed limit was how many miles per hour?
The posted speed limit is 50 miles per hour on the roadway in which Mr. Murphy was driving, 45 miles per hour on the intersecting roadway, the Brick Mill Road. I was mistaken to the extent I said 45 okay. earlier.
So the defendant in this case, who you allege to have acted willfully and wantonly or recklessly, had a posted speed limit of 50 miles per hour.
50 miles per hour is on page 101.
And the evidence shows that he was doing 50 to 55 miles per hour?
Going through the intersection.
I understand that.
Going through the intersection without even looking at the
light. At the time of the collision, which occurred in the intersection, he was doing between 50 and 55.
Correct, by his own concession. And the second point, Your Honor, is the other point I'd like to make in rebuttal is that this was not a situation where Mr. Murphy's attention was diverted because of a dog barking or a child incident or anything else in the car. Ms. Lewis said that she asked Mr. Murphy whether the driver was on Route 1 and what type of car it was. Mr. Murphy said yes as to Route 1 and the name of the car. That's found at page A112 of the docket of the appendix. Mr. Murphy's recollection is he looked at Ms. Lewis to tell her what kind of car it was and what direction it was heading. That's Mr. Murphy's sworn testimony of deposition found at A130. So the justification here for taking one's eyes off the road and continuing to travel at 50 to 55 miles per hour into an area where one would have known there was an intersection was to tell the female escort what the type of kind of car it was and what direction it was heading. This is not something where someone has to turn their head from the roadway because of a dog barking, a child doing anything. It's to turn your head to speak to somebody who's on a cell phone and has been on a cell phone for some time. And that's the justification for taking one's eyes off the roadway. And that, we say, is a question of fact of whether it rises to the level of conscious indifference, which is the Jardel standard. We did allege in the complaint that the conduct here was willful and wanton and a number of other motor vehicle violations.
But am I correct in understanding that even if the trial court ruled incorrectly on whether it goes to the jury for the willful and wanton or recklessness, it still wouldn't help your client because there was a finding of no conscious pain and suffering, unless we also were to hold that punitive damages are available notwithstanding the absence of conscious pain and suffering?
That is correct.
Okay.
And the jury verdict sheet that Mr. Nierjowski referred to is found at page 375 and 376. The question was that plaintiff's decedent, Alberto Reyes, suffered some interval of conscious pain and suffering after the injury but prior to the death. The jury answered no. Under the McGee standard, that eliminates compensatory damage. That's the end of that issue, the survival action. Our argument is that under 3701, where the legislature said all actions survive, that there should be a surviving action for punitive damages even if the death was instantaneous because the loss was the ultimate loss. It was the loss of life, even if there's no compensatory damages to the estate for that. It's the loss of life to which the estate is entitled.
But it's the absence of compensatory damages that also means that your client did not prevail on its survivorship claim.
Correct.
So we would need to say that when a judgment is entered in favor of a defendant, that a plaintiff can still recover punitive damages under certain circumstances.
Yes, the elimination of the compensatory damages in the survival action does not necessarily, in the willful and wanton situation, eliminate a determination of punitive damages for willful and wanton misconduct.
What compensatory damages were you seeking?
In this case, it was for pain and suffering, because our argument was that she survived. We had an expert who testified that she had conscious pain and suffering from anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes, based upon the evidence produced at the scene by the lay witnesses and the EMS.
So in the future, we're going to have something that we call a survival action when the decedent really didn't survive. And in this action we're calling the survival action, the sole purpose will be to award punitive damages if the reason there was instantaneous death is attributable to recklessness or willful or wanton conduct.
Correct, because the willful and wanton, because the punitive damages cannot be awarded in the wrongful death. So if you do not have that, then a tortfeasor who causes instantaneous death is not exposed to punitive damages.
And obviously there would have been a whole different set of interrogatories sent to the jury had the trial judge allowed them to decide recklessness, put punitive damages in issue.
Yes, sir.
Your position is they could have said, no, she didn't survive to generate any of the compensatory damages, but we still find in favor of the plaintiff on punitive damages because we have already found the defendant's conduct to have been reckless or willful and wanton.
We would have to have tried that issue, but yes, because the state conceded negligence after that and conceded at one point in time no comparative negligence, we would have other issues in the case, but yes, there would be a whole bunch of
other questions. And, of course, they've never, for obvious reasons, have conceded reckless conduct.
That is correct. We did not expect them to do that.
One last question, and taking this to its logical extension then, under the scenario that you posited, judgment for the defendant on the survivorship claim, the punitive damages, if awarded, would then go to the estate, whereas the wrongful death damages go to the next of kin. So.
That is correct. It may not necessarily flow in the same direction, depending on what the estate plan is.
I'm sorry, but I'm holding everybody up here. I have one more question. The jury never got to consider punitive damages, right?
That is correct.
Okay. And let's assume the jury was going to consider punitive damages. Would the jury also basically be told, listen, under the existing law, let's assume the law hasn't changed any, under the existing law, in order to find punitive damages, you have to find some amount, even a nominal amount, but you have to find some amount of compensatory damages. Therefore, you know, you can't answer yes to punitive damages unless you find that yes to the question of was there any conscious pain and suffering. Would that arguably result potentially in the jury saying, well, you know, there was evidence that this person survived for a minute or two, so we're going to say yes here because we think this is a case that properly ought to be given punitive damages?
With all due deference to Your Honor, I don't think I would phrase it quite that way if I was a Superior Court judge. I think I would paraphrase, I think it was the Maryland Supreme Court quoted in our supplemental opening brief, in which they said that even if there is no economic loss, you have the loss of life, which is a form of nominal damages, which will support an award of punitive damages. It may not be any dollar amount for that loss of life in the compensatory aspect, but you still have the punitive aspect on top of that.
Thank you.
Before you sit down, unfortunately, now I have another question. The jury comes back under the scenario that you propose in a new trial. They again find no compensatory damages. Then they award $1 million in punitive damages. How do we assess whether the punitive damages are reasonably related to zero compensatory damages? Hasn't the United States Supreme Court said that punitive damages have to be reasonably related to the injury?
And
how do you measure one person's death vis-a-vis another person's death in the absence of any economic damages?
And there is a Supreme Court case cited in our supplemental briefs on that issue which addresses that, because it is a common question where you have violation of constitutional rights, where there may be little or no economic loss for violation of freedom of speech, but yet there still can be a significant punitive damage award, and we quoted the Supreme Court case on that in one of our briefs, and I don't have it on the top of my head.
How about the Supreme Court case that was just decided a few weeks ago?
I haven't reviewed that, candidly, Your Honor, but because I just didn't do research on all the cases, bringing them up to date for argument. Certainly would be willing to address that, but I think in the area where you have the ultimate loss of life, even without compensatory damages, that you have something other than your rule of thumb on punitive damages being related to compensatory damages.
Well, but evaluating whether punitive damages are reasonable or not, you get into an issue then of whose life as opposed to who others, someone else's life, is worth X, Y, or Z. That's very difficult to rationally evaluate with no measuring stick of compensatory damages, isn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it's an issue for the jury to decide based upon all the circumstances in the case. Here we had some set aspects. We had a 75-year-old lady who fairly much undisputed, have by statute, by statistics, 12 more years of life left. We are not dealing here. I think there's a measuring rod with loss of life, whether it's a teenager, someone in mid-age, or senior, and I think the jury can take that all into consideration.
I take that as a reasonable answer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Taken under advisement, recess.